This is KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. By now, you know, a judge yesterday blocked President Trump's attempt to withhold funding from sanctuary cities like Seattle. On Twitter today, Trump is calling the decision ridiculous. Quote, see you in the Supreme Court. Of course, the city of Seattle is taking the president to court over this sanctuary city issue. We are going to catch you up now, not just on sanctuary cities, but on Trump's progress overall on one of his signature priorities, immigration. Here to do that is USA Today's immigration reporter, Alan Gomez. Alan, welcome to KUOW.
Thanks for having me.
What's most interesting to you about this week's federal court ruling blocking Trump's threat against sanctuary cities?
Well, I think it's fascinating on two fronts. First off, what it does is it, for the first time, really puts limits on what the Trump administration can do to punish sanctuary cities. You know, I think the big headline coming out of that ruling was that the judge blocked him and completely stopped him, but it wasn't a complete block. So basically what the judge said was that the Trump administration can withhold federal funding through a couple of grants that run through the Justice Department that deal only with law enforcement. They can withhold those grants from locals that don't fully comply with federal immigration authorities. But what the judge said is that their threats to withhold all federal funding, so think about transportation, housing, all these other areas where the feds send money down to the locals, that they can't use that as a threat against these local communities. So it sort of set the parameters, it set the guidelines for how the administration can do that. But the other thing that it did, which I think is really fascinating and one that is going to matter a lot there in Seattle and in almost every city around the country, is the judge kind of asked the department to finally define what a sanctuary city is or what they consider a sanctuary city to be.
Yes, sanctuary city essentially is not fully cooperating with federal immigration enforcers, but it's really vague.
Yeah, I mean, what you just said right there has been interpreted by I don't know how many people over I don't know how many years as classifying for a sanctuary city. You know, the short answer from the Department of Homeland Security right now, or the Department of Justice, is that you are a sanctuary city if you violate 8 U.S.C. 1373. That is a federal law that requires locals to at least share immigration information with federal authorities. But these departments are apparently interpreting that to mean a lot more than it may. So they're saying if you're not holding suspects for immigration authorities, that you're not fully cooperating with ICE. If they say you're not handing over all the immigration information on all of your suspects in jails, you might be in violation of that. So there's a lot of shades of gray in there, and there's a lot of disagreements. There's a lot of different ways that local cities handle their cooperation with the feds when it comes to immigration. And what all these cities are saying is just show us where that line is so we can figure out and respond accordingly.
Yeah, you're in Miami, Alan, where unlike Seattle, your city said, okay, we won't do this undefined thing.
Yeah, I mean, and Miami, I think, is just the perfect case study of the rampant confusion going on over this. Basically, when Trump signed an executive order back in January saying that he would punish sanctuary cities by withholding federal funding if they didn't fully comply with federal immigration laws, the next day, the mayor of Miami-Dade County, mind you, this is a county that is more than 50% foreign-born, so this is a land of immigrants. This is, you know, the gateway to Latin America. But the day after, the mayor said, okay, fine, we're going to fully comply with everything. We're going to hold suspects for you if you ask us to. We're going to share all our information with you. And he took a lot of heat. You know, people in this city were rabid and enraged. And still, last week, they got a letter from the Department of Justice saying that they might be in violation of federal laws regarding immigration and that they may lose Justice Department funding. So, you know, their answer was sort of like, what? Excuse me? So that, I think, kind of gives you an idea of just how confusing this is right now and that nobody really has a clear answer of what a sanctuary city is.
What about Trump's immigration policy overall? Here we are 100 days in. What is his effect on undocumented immigration so far, or just immigration he doesn't like?
I mean, right now, for you know, it's everyone's trying to grade him on different areas, and what I would say is that in the immigration world, I mean, this is probably the area where that transition from campaign rhetoric to actual governance has been most difficult for him. I mean, we can run down the list here. He tried to institute a travel ban to limit legal immigration from majority Muslim countries so that his administration could have time to improve the vetting of people coming from those countries. That's twice been blocked now by the federal courts, as you guys in Washington State are very well aware of, since they led that charge.
Right.
You know, we have this ruling from the judge today that is seriously restricting his ability to punish sanctuary cities who are not fully complying with federal immigration laws. Also this week, Congress basically forced the Trump administration to withdraw its request for about $1.4 billion as a down payment on his border wall, saying this isn't the time, let's push this off till later in the fall. So you run down that list and, you know, some of his core campaign promises that he was going to institute a Muslim ban, that he was going to build that big, beautiful border wall, and that he was going to punish sanctuary cities have all been stopped by the other branches of government. The one area where he's absolutely, if you want to call it, succeeded or been able to implement what he's promised is on the question of deportations. They have increased dramatically. The deportation of people with criminal records has increased. The number of people without criminal records who have been deported has increased. And even some folks who have been given federal deportation protections under President Obama, they're starting to get caught up in that mix as well. So that's one area. His deportation force has absolutely gone out and started acting almost immediately, started pursuing that part. So that's the one area where he's starting to fulfill his promises.
Yeah, one of those childhood arrivals caught up. There's one in the Seattle area, Daniel Ramirez. So there was this big question, is Trump going to have a massive deportation force and send out millions and millions of people? What do you think?
Well, it's, you know, I think the size of the force, the way that that deportation force looks, that's going to be negotiated over several months because he needs money from Congress to do that. But what he was able to do, and which has had an immediate impact, is to refocus and reprioritize the agents that are already out there in the field. So just one quick example. Before, under President Obama, when they would go on these big immigration raids, they've done quite a bit of them over the years in Washington, around Portland, around some of the farms in eastern Washington state. And so what they do is, under Obama, they would have targets, they would go get them, and they would round them up, and that was it. But they were restricted. They were not allowed to get sort of what they call collateral damage, other people who they happened to encounter during that raid. Under President Trump, that is absolutely okay. So if they're going after, let's say, a convicted drug offender, or they're going after a rapist who is in the country illegally, if they go get him, but there happen to be three other people in that apartment, they can question all three of them. And if they're here undocumented, whether they have a criminal history or not, they'll pick them up too, and they'll be deported as well. So that's just one example of the way that they've sort of expanded who they target and how they round people up. Before, you had to be convicted of a crime to be a priority for deportation. Now you only have to be charged with a crime to be a priority for deportation. So in many ways, that day-to-day operation of the deportation force has changed. It's sort of like unleashed them to go after anybody they encounter on the street.
Finally, Alan, the big picture is that our immigration system is messed up. It doesn't work. Would any president be able to make it functional?
Well, I mean, that's something I haven't seen in my lifetime. I mean, it's, you know, I've covered immigration for many years now, and the only thing that I've heard widespread agreement on is that nothing's going to change until Congress updates our immigration laws. Right now, we're operating under an immigration system that was set up in 1965. There have been tweaks along the way. There have been changes here and there, depending on who's in power and those kind of things. But you know, the reason we have so many undocumented immigrants in this country, the reason it's so hard for businesses to get the kind of workers they need, the reason that there's these incredibly years-long lines to get into the country legally is because we're working under a 50-some-year-old system that has not been able to keep up with the changing demands of our economy, of our population. And that's why it's just so imperative for Congress to, you know, one day get together and try to update this thing. Having been in Washington and watching firsthand the immigration fight in 2013, when the Senate passed the comprehensive immigration bill, that was an incredibly difficult battle. It was hard, but they passed it, and then the House didn't even take it up. So that was kind of a deflating moment, I think, for anybody who wanted to see that kind of immigration change, but it also shows just how difficult it is to get that kind of massive change in the political, extreme political climate that we're living in.
Letting you in on one of the most fascinating beats in this country, USA Today's immigration reporter, Alan Gomez. Alan, great to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Have you ever bought distressed clothes, like jeans that are pre-faded or even worn or shredded to look lovingly used before anybody's used them? Well, you could say Nordstrom's just taking that a little further. The Seattle department chain is now selling men's jeans covered with, as they call it, a crackled, caked-on, muddy coating. Price $425. Nordstrom is getting the predictable backlash. For example, Mike Rowe is the popular host of the Discovery show Dirty Jobs, a tribute to the value of manual labor. And he writes, "Finally, a pair of jeans that look like they've been worn by someone with a dirty job, made for people who don't." Is this retail move lame or brilliant? Because we're talking about it right now. Cal McAllister is the founder and creative director for the Wexley School for Girls. Hey, Cal.
Hey, Bill. How's it going?
Good, thank you. You call this move by Nordstrom laughable. Why is that?
Well, I think that it, at this point, is just insensitive. Fashion does interesting and intentionally funny things all the time, but I think it's just a flag for wage discrimination right now, and nobody that can afford to drop $425 on a pair of pants has a job that will turn those pants into what these look like.
But, of course, I assume Nordstrom wanted – did Nordstrom want the opposite reaction, or did they want that reaction because that's how they get publicity, because it's outrageous?
It is pretty outrageous. And Nordstrom, you know, they're a high-end retailer, and part of their responsibility is to show what the fashion world is doing. And there's $450 T-shirts that everybody will also laugh at when they walk in the stores. But it's their job to be the insight into the fashion world. I think that this one just hit a nerve because of the people who actually are working hard, more than just on the weekends digging up their gardens to make their jeans dirty. They just sort of missed on this one.
I want to make sure that you're sure that they're hitting a nerve in a bad way, because as I said, we're talking about it. I mean, can you tell when the reaction is, shows you, oh, this didn't work?
Well, I think that in this era you can, especially in the age of social media, and you can just ask Uber from their missteps not too long ago when the hashtag delete your Uber app was pretty hot. So any publicity is good publicity, doesn't work in this day and age.
Now, this is not the first time they've come out with these, you could call them stunt products. Nordstrom got mocked for the clear plastic leg jeans and for the shoes with the socks built in, and of course the rock in a leather bag. What are they up to? What's Nordstrom doing?
Well, Nordstrom is in an interesting spot because they're brick-and-mortar retail, and between flash sites and the Bonobos of the world, a lot of people are ordering their clothes, especially their high-end clothes, online. The old idea that you had to go in and try it on if you're going to spend a lot of money for it, it's not the same as that's just not how it's being practiced as much anymore. So they have to attract the younger audience. They have to show their relevancy to the younger audience, and that's what they're trying to do. And Nordstrom generally is very successful at that. This is you have to take risks, and you have to fail sometimes. They'll learn from this. They're a good company and doing smart things, but they're just trying to show their relevance to a younger age group.
Okay, maybe they went too far with the crackle caked on muddy coating. I think you said that you thought this was especially a bad idea in Seattle. Why do you say that?
Well, I think that we're really sensitive to traditionally blue-collar workers. You know, we know how hard people work over in the orchards and picking apples, and Seattle is already a little irritated just by where we are with the state of the current administration and some of the things that are happening literally daily as the big banks are getting tax rollbacks, and nothing's really happening in some of the promises for the lower-wage workers. So I think Seattle's very sensitive to that. We're a technology-savvy city. We have our ear to the ground, and we're listening to all of our news outlets, and it's just a tricky time to do anything just on the fringe of interesting with labor right now.
Yeah, the fake mud, caked-on mud, struck some people as more a big city suburb or an L.A. thing, or so, but not Seattle. I wonder, though, does a company as big as Nordstrom that's headquartered in Seattle, do they really have to pay much attention to what flies in Seattle particularly?
Well, I wouldn't let any market dictate your entire sales strategy, so they don't have to pay attention to what happens in Seattle, but they do have to realize that this is the headquarters and this is the heart of their business and this is their distribution center. So they just have to know that what happens here represents the vision of the entire company. And it may work in other places. I don't know that this one will in particular, but I think that you have to be aware of where your core is, and you have to be aware of where the heart of your business starts.
Okay. Try again, Nordstrom, says Cal McAllister, founder and creative director for the Wexley School for Girls. Good to talk with you again, Cal.
Yeah, I'll invite you over to my house. I have a pair of jeans from working in the yard last weekend. $100 if you want them.
I would pay. That's cheap at twice the price. Thank you, Cal.
Phil.
All right, see ya. It's KUOW's The Record. Nordstrom charging $400 for some muddy jeans. Let's talk now about what's been in the ground for how long. Because when you wonder how long human beings have been in the Americas, experts figure it's been about 15,000 years. Well, now comes a claim that there are signs of humans having been here 130,000 years ago in what's now California. The evidence consists of stone tools next to the broken bones of a mastodon and signs that people use those tools to harvest bone marrow. 15,000 years to 130,000. That's a big gap. Why does it matter? You'll hear the whole story later this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. Today, the city of Seattle announced a partnership on homelessness, a partnership with billionaire Paul Allen. The Microsoft co-founder will spend $30 million on housing and services for families with children who are experiencing homelessness. Now, Seattle is lucky to have so many generous billionaires, Paul Allen, Bill Gates, Steve Ballmer, and many less famous donors. But could billionaire philanthropy also be a threat to democracy? Yes, says author and philanthropy expert David Callahan. We have more and more rich Americans directing their money while the government's cutting budgets for social services and programs. Callahan told KUOW's David Hyde that that shift from the public sector to private philanthropy is massive.
It's big. There's about 30,000 new foundations, private foundations that have been created in the last 15 years. Bill Gates used to be kind of alone among these new mega donors, but there's more and more of them every time you turn around. Steve Ballmer, another familiar name in Seattle, is just starting his philanthropy in a big way. He's one of the richest people in the world. There's a lot of these mega billionaires who are going to start wielding more and more influence over different parts of society in ways both good and bad. But ultimately, it does raise questions as to who has power in our society.
And there are quite a few of these billionaire donors here in the Seattle area. Who, according to your metrics, is making the world a better place?
I certainly would say that Bill Gates has made the world a better place with his public health philanthropy in poor countries. That, to me, is a great example of a philanthropist going after what I call the low-hanging fruit, vaccinations that can really make a huge difference.
So why is that kind of philanthropy good?
It's good because these philanthropists are going after solvable problems in a way that doesn't kind of bigfoot over other citizens. You know, it's not like the education philanthropy, which is a lot more controversial because that's a democratic institution we care about.
Well, let me ask about that. Bill Gates has also been a donor to education philanthropies. How's that worked out?
It's not worked out so well. It's been really a mixed bag, as he himself has acknowledged, because K-12 is a tough problem to solve. Reforming that system, it's a $600 billion system, 10,000 different school districts. It's that's what I would call the high-hanging fruit when it comes to philanthropy. And those efforts have been very controversial. People don't like billionaires swooping into their school district to make plans for how their children are educated.
So is billionaire philanthropy an example of political activism?
Some of it is, for sure. Michael Bloomberg has been a leader in trying to shut down coal-fired power plants, giving $130 million to the Sierra Club. The biggest donor in the history of the Sierra Club is Michael Bloomberg.
And there's a lot of talk these days about the resistance to President Donald Trump. There's a lot of things happening here in Washington State. What role are billionaires playing in that thing, if it is a thing, the resistance?
Well, every time you have a president with a big, ambitious agenda, it produces a counter-mobilization among wealthy donors. Obama was fought by billionaires like the Koch brothers. And with Donald Trump, we're seeing billionaires like Pierre Omidyar and Tom Steyer, Michael Bloomberg, George Soros, who are stepping up to kind of combat that Trump agenda. And lots of money is flowing to activist organizations from deep-pocketed donors right now.
So what's wrong with billionaires being activists, billionaires getting involved with things that are a little bit political, like education reform?
many citizens already feel like their voice doesn't count. They feel that the wealthy have too much power in society. We live in an age of tremendous economic inequality, and there's lots of signs that that's translating into political inequality because the wealthy have so many more resources to affect public policy and public life. You know, in a democracy, the ideal is that all of us can be heard equally. And we're far from that ideal. We've heard a lot about all the money and going for political campaign contributions. I suggest that this philanthropic money is another form of money in politics, or can be, when it's used for activist causes. What I would like to see is an America where everybody does have an equal voice in our democracy, but we're headed in the opposite direction with billionaires able to put their thumb on the scale of these issues and really move the agenda.
Why is this happening?
For the past three decades, we've seen a huge accumulation of wealth at the very top of the income ladder. The Forbes 400 have a combined net worth of $2.5 trillion. Many of those people have signed the Giving Pledge, which was developed by Warren Buffett and Bill Gates to induce more giving by billionaires. And a lot of that money is going to be hitting the charitable and nonprofit sector. And so this is really the next chapter in the historic inequality we've seen in this second Gilded Age.
What's the worst case scenario if this second Gilded Age continues on the same train that it's been on, kind of moving forward?
Well, one scenario is that the wealthy end up basically controlling civil society and also taking over many of the functions that government does. I mean, all this new philanthropy is happening at a time that government is facing historic constraints on its resources. You know, government budget cuts are hitting at the federal, state, and local level. That was true even before Donald Trump became elected, and it's going to be more true going forward. And that means government has fewer resources to do things and solve problems. Private philanthropy has more resources, so we're seeing a power shift away from government, which is accountable to all citizens, to these kind of super citizen donors who are accountable to nobody.
But if conservative activists like Grover Norquist is hearing this, he's going, this all sounds great. What's wrong with that?
Well, it may sound great to Grover Norquist, but it doesn't sound great to me. My concern is that we're heading into a kind of privatized future with a benign plutocracy. I think many of these donors have the best of intentions. They want to give back. They want to do something positive in the world. But they're not the people who should be in the driver's seat of American life.
David Callahan is founder and editor of Inside Philanthropy. His new book is The Givers: Money, Power, and Philanthropy in a New Gilded Age. He talked with David Hyde of KUOW's politics team. This is KUOW's The Record. As we've been reporting this hour, immigration has been a headache for President Trump, from the border wall to yesterday's court ruling blocking his order against sanctuary cities. And of course, Washington State successfully sued Trump over his first travel ban, the one that suddenly blocked people coming in from some majority Muslim countries. Even travelers with green cards and visas got swept up in that ban. There was confusion at SeaTac and other airports, which prompted a KUOW listener named Pam Jensen to send this question to Local Wonder.
What was the cost to people who were caught up in the turmoil of the first travel ban while they were en route to Seattle?
We asked KUOW's Ruby DeLuna from our immigration team to look into Pam's question.
Most travelers who were caught up in the confusion had to eat the costs of rebooking flights, but several airlines were sympathetic. Some offered refunds, others waived the rebooking fees. But if you're a refugee, the cost of the travel ban comes in many forms.
اسمي هبة الحمداني.
My name is Hiba Alhamadani.
Hiba Alhamadani is 32 years old. She told her story through an interpreter. About 3 years ago, Alhamadani fled her home in Iraq to Turkey.
Life is impossible in Iraq right now. As a divorced single mom with two kids, it's tough to live there. No job opportunities and no peace for the kids. I don't feel safe for them to leave the house.
Alhamadani and her sons applied for refugee status to the U.S. It was granted 2 years later. Her flight was scheduled for February 9th.
I was ready to travel, so I sold everything, the furniture, the apartment. I canceled the lease.
She was going to stay with a friend until their flight. But just days before, she got a phone call.
They said there is no travel for 4 months, and then it's up to you if you want to go back or if you want to move your case to another country.
Al-Hamadani says she was shocked and upset. The travel ban put her and her sons in limbo for another 3 years. Going back to Iraq was not an option.
The most stressful thing was it's about my kids, because when I moved from Iraq to Turkey, they were still young kids.
But now her oldest son is almost 16 years old. The younger one will be 11. They haven't been to school since they fled Iraq. For Al-Hamadani, the travel ban has a different kind of cost. It thwarted their hopes for an education.
And with no education, no school, what will happen? What future?
Al-Hamadani wasn't the only one in limbo.
This is a list of what we call assured cases.
Greg Hope is director of the Refugee Resettlement Program of the Episcopal Diocese of Olympia. The list contains the names of people who've been approved for refugee status. Hope says there were about 5 other refugees like Al-Hamadani whose flights were delayed because of the first travel ban.
But as soon as the court order came from Seattle, they pretty much got on a plane and came.
The first travel ban has been replaced with a second one. That, too, is going through the legal process. There are 99 refugees on Hope's list waiting to be resettled while there's still a window. Normally, their arrival would be spaced out, but it's been hectic, says Hope. For refugees, the alternative is a life with no prospects.
I mean, they're in a camp or they're in a situation where there's just not a lot for them. And they're not a part of those societies. And they can't go back to their homeland.
Al-Hamadani and her sons finally made it to Seattle 2 months ago. They live in Kent. The kids are now going to school.
I cannot forget my feeling when I took my kids to school the first day here. My dream came true.
A new life in America comes with new realities. Refugees like Al-Hamadani are responsible for their airfare coming here, but often they don't have the means to pay for it up front, so they're given an interest-free loan. Before the trip, they sign a promissory note that says within 3 months after their arrival, they'll start paying it off. I'm Ruby DeLuna, KUOW News.
That story was inspired by a question from KUOW listener Pam Jensen in Seattle. You can hear more stories from our Local Wonders series at our website, KUOW.org. And while you're there, leave us your local wonder about our Puget Sound region. If we choose your question, then a KUOW reporter will investigate it. Now, in President Trump's first 100 days, he's done several things that affect immigrants and refugees in Seattle. Travel bans, increased enforcement, crackdowns on sanctuary cities. KUOW's immigration team has this look back at some of the voices we heard in Trump's first 3 months.
I'm establishing new vetting measures to keep radical Islamic terrorists out of the United States of America. We don't want them here.
The airport chaos started just hours after President Trump's executive order. Washington Governor Jay Inslee called the action incompetent and blatant religious discrimination.
What type of inhumane attitude allows that to happen in this nation?
We do provide attorneys at Guantanamo Bay. We should be able to provide attorneys right here at SeaTac Airport. We will not let this stand.
President Trump made a commitment as a candidate, Trump, to protect America and America's first, and he did just that.
I still remember the day that the order was signed, and it was literally like somebody had just punched us in the stomach. It was just like the air just came, it was out.
We're here today to announce that I'm filing a lawsuit today in federal court against President Trump. It asked the court to declare key provisions of President Trump's executive order on immigration unconstitutional.
Even if it were a Muslim ban, it would be legal. Judges have no legal right to interfere in these questions, because if this precedent stands, the American people will no longer have the authority to decide who gets to come in and who is kept out of their own country.
Friends and family welcomed a Syrian refugee named Jada Al-Halabi at SeaTac Airport yesterday. Speaking through an interpreter, she said it was the best day of her life.
We're very thankful that we're now back together and just to be as we were before, my family. And thank you to everyone who helped my family.
What do you want people to know about you and the other so-called dreamers who were brought here undocumented as kids?
It's a fight. These are the most resilient people that you will meet. They're fighting every day for existence. We are exposed every day when we walk down the streets, but we still fight.
To me, Trump made it okay to be, you know, racist. And I was worried for me and my family. There have never been a day that goes by that I did not wish I was white. Ever since Trump won, like, I just want to know what it feels like.
I strongly urge our nation, states, and cities and counties to consider carefully the harm they are doing to their citizens by refusing to enforce our immigration laws and to rethink these policies. Such policies make their cities and states less safe and put them at risk of losing federal dollars.
It should not be, and we should not allow the federal government to use local police and our agencies to act as a federal militia. And that's exactly what they're doing.
You know, we spent a lot of time during the election talking about the terrible things that might happen. The last 5 days have proved that it's going to happen. I'm willing to lose every single penny to protect those people.
You can find those stories and a timeline of President Trump's first 100 days when you go to KUOW.org. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. We want to make sure the scourge that is on Seattle's doorstep does not come over here. That's what Bellevue City Council member Kevin Wallace said recently at a council meeting discussing where to open Bellevue's first permanent shelter for homeless men. Councilmember Wallace, welcome to KUOW.
Thanks.
What did you mean by your comment about the scourge on Seattle's doorstep not coming to Bellevue?
Yeah, I should have known that one would get sort of taken out of context. The reference is not to the people that are in homelessness. It's a reference to the tents and garbage that are strewn along the rights of way in Seattle. And to me, that's not about the homeless people. It's about the city's solutions to homelessness, and that's really where the problem lies. So in Bellevue, what we're focused on is providing a solution where people have a place to go to get out of the cold. And we don't believe, or I don't believe that anyway, that that a situation where the homeless are camping in tents and living in areas along the freeway strewn with garbage is an acceptable outcome for the city of Bellevue, or any city for that matter.
Right. So Bellevue is considering and planning on a permanent shelter, so it's not tents and garbage. Does that mean you're in favor of the shelter?
Oh, absolutely. Bellevue's been working with Congregations for the Homeless for over a generation in providing an opportunity to transition out of homelessness. And I don't want that to just continue. I want it to be better than it is today. So we will continue to work. As far as I'm concerned, the city will continue to work with Congregations for the Homeless to provide a great solution for homelessness. But that solution is about transitioning people out of homelessness, not allowing them to be perpetually homeless.
There's been some controversy about where this shelter would go. Right now, option one seems to be the Eastgate neighborhood, but there's still discussion about, well, maybe Belred, maybe downtown. What are some of the concerns right. You have with putting it in the Eastgate neighborhood?
Yeah, so first of all, we have to understand that this project is still in its early conceptual design stages. We were learning more about whether it made sense to put a facility at Eastgate. And I think what I learned over the last 8 months is that because it's a new location, and it's proximate to a lot of single-family neighborhoods, that it doesn't make sense to put a low-barrier shelter there
Low barrier meaning, we should explain.
It's one of those buzzwords that may not mean the same thing to all people.
Right.
But I think what it means to me is that basically a facility that's set up to deal with people that have all types of problems that led them to homelessness. It just isn't being on hard luck. So, you know, it could be sex offenders or mentally ill or other people that where there just needs to be a more comprehensive set of solutions to work with them.
An ongoing addiction would not keep you out of the shelter, perhaps?
Well, right. And so there's a place for that type of facility. We need to have a solution like that for Bellevue in the East Side. But the question is whether it should be in Eastgate near people's homes or whether we should put it back where it was. It was at the maintenance facility that Sound Transit condemned. The building that was there before that they condemned and have now demolished to make way for their maintenance facility is where Congregations for the Homeless was before they acquired it. Nobody complained about the low-barrier homeless shelter in that location when it was there for years. And I'm just saying, let's put the low-barrier homeless shelter back where it was.
The Seattle Times reported that in the debate over where to open this men's homeless shelter, somebody said the shelter will reflect Bellevue values. And yesterday we heard two men who provide services for homeless people in Bellevue discuss that, and across the East Side, in fact. And they said it's about getting all parties to come together to make sure we're treating people like people and to make sure people actually have a path out. And it sounds like you agree with that.
Oh, absolutely. And David Bowling and Steve Roberts, Congregations for the Homeless, do a fantastic job serving the needs of the homeless in Bellevue and the East Side. And I'm thrilled to be able to continue the partnership with them to enable them to do what they do and continue to do it well.
What do you think are Bellevue values when it comes to homelessness?
Yeah. So Bellevue's stated values is that homelessness should be one time, brief, and rare. And that's a goal, right? It's not going to happen in every situation. But what it says to me, and I should note that this interview is my views, not the city's views as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
But what that says to me is that our goal is to be trying to transition people out of homelessness. And that's basically if people are refusing the goal and saying, I don't want to transition out of homeless, I want to remain in a tent by the right-of-way or in your parks, that's where the compact ends. And, you know, Bellevue, so the balance is we provide an opportunity for people that find themselves in homelessness to get out of homelessness and a place for them to stay, but we don't allow people to pitch tents in the right-of-way and in city parks and just live there perpetually.
Councilmember Kevin Wallace, you've been on the Bellevue City Council 8 years, and you've lived in Bellevue most of your life. How have you seen this issue, homelessness, change over the years?
As the city continues to grow and the economy changes, the city and the East Side as a whole has seen more homeless needs, not just from people coming in from Seattle or other cities, but really from, you know, homegrown, if you will, homelessness. So this is something that we certainly have to continue to make a high priority, providing a transitional solution to homelessness on the East Side. And we're doing that. Really, the question is, with the Eastgate discussion, is about where these facilities should go. It's not about the willingness of the city to design a great facility. And I hope that we can do both, put it in the right location and make it a great facility.
What is the biggest difference between how Bellevue and Seattle are approaching homelessness?
You know, Seattle has its own set of problems, and I'm not an expert. I'm not going to say what the cause of Seattle's issues with tents in the right-of-way and that kind of thing is. What I can say is that's not an acceptable outcome to me. As a leader of the city of Bellevue, I will not stand for tents in the right-of-way, tents in parks, garbage strewn everywhere. That's just not an acceptable outcome. So what we focus on is a plan to transition people out of homelessness, to provide a facility for them to go so they don't have to put live in tents in an uncontrolled manner, and then transition them and work with case managers to transition them out of homelessness, try to get them the help they need to be self-sustaining.
What do you think Bellevue is doing that's working?
The plan that Congregations for the Homeless, Sophia Way, and the other nonprofits that serve the needs of the human service needs of the East Side really have been working well. And I think continuing the plan to let them do what they do well is the right solution. In this case, we're dealing with the need to, because Sound Transit came in and disrupted the facility they have, it's now in an interim location, and we need to find a help them find a permanent place because this is a permanent issue. And that's what we're doing.
Yes, that discussion continues about where to place Bellevue's first permanent men's shelter. And it's good to talk with you about it, Councilmember Kevin Wallace of Bellevue. Thank you for this.
Thanks for the opportunity.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. And this just in, filmmaker Jonathan Demme has died. He died this morning. Complications from cancer. Demme made big budget Hollywood movies, Silence of the Lambs, Philadelphia, and he made documentaries about Haiti and rockumentaries about Talking Heads and Neil Young. We're going to listen to some of Jonathan Demme's work later this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. Is our border with Canada thickening? Not sickening, thickening? That's what Canada's Prime Minister warned of yesterday after President Trump slapped new tariffs on Canadian softwood lumber. Trump accuses Canada of unfairly subsidizing its lumber and its dairy products.
People don't realize Canada has been very rough in the United States. Everyone thinks of Canada as being wonderful, and so do I. I love Canada. But they've outsmarted our politicians for many years, and you people understand that. So we did institute a very big tariff. We're going to take care of our dairy farmers in Wisconsin and upstate New York and lots of other places. So I think you people all probably agree with that, right? Would you agree with that?
I would.
You better believe it, everybody.
Mr. President, do you fear a trade war with Canada, sir? Do you fear a trade war with Canada, sir?
No, not at all.
Why not?
They have a tremendous surplus with the United States. Whenever they have a surplus, I have no fear.
Trump has no fear of a trade war, yet today, British Columbia's premier is talking about retaliation. Christy Clark wants to ban American thermal coal from British Columbia's ports. Let's bring in Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Hi, Vaughn.
Man, this thing's turning ugly quickly.
How about that? Is this the beginning of a trade war? What's up?
Well, I hope not, because the economies of the two countries are so integrated that, you know, it's very hard to pick any one area and not hurt people on both sides of the border. There are all kinds of Americans who make their living making stuff that ends up in Canada, and manufacturing goes back and forth. So off the top, I hope that's not where we're headed. I'll acknowledge as a Canadian that we did start this time with a stupid decision by the Canadian government to suddenly, overnight, cut off shipments of milk, specialty milk products, from dairies in Wisconsin to Canada. This is a special kind of milk. It's used to make cheese and yogurt. They've been shipping it back and forth for years, and suddenly all these farmers in Wisconsin get this letter saying no longer. They're in danger of going out of business, and politically stupid as well, Bill, because Wisconsin's one of the states that Trump won. To get the presidency, so of course they have his ear. A clumsy, stupid decision. Canada's milk industry, dairy industry, is heavily, heavily protected. Every one of our trading partners has complained about it over the years. So on that one, I think the president's right, and we should do something. The softwood one, we've thought about this between Canada and the United States for years. This is the fifth round of the softwood wars. We exchange rhetoric from both sides. We win some. American lumber industry wins some. Each one of these battles ends the same way. We reach an agreement between the two countries to limit the Canadian export of lumber to the United States. That's where this will end up as well, so we can sort it out. But against that backdrop, you've got some heated rhetoric and a politician running for re-election in British Columbia, Christy Clark, going after thermal coal from Wyoming, so it ain't over yet.
For anybody who doesn't know, by the way, softwood, we say softwood, it comes from evergreens like pine trees, and American lumber is on private land pretty much, and Canadian trees are public, and the U.S. thinks you don't charge enough to cut trees on your public land. Is that basically it?
That's right, and if they control the trade, it drives up the price of building a home in the United States. They figured about $3,000 drives up the price of lumber. The thermal coal one is interesting, Bill, because people in Washington State will know that the Wyoming coal producers have been having trouble getting their product to Asian markets through West Coast ports. Longview's blocked it, Bellingham's blocked it, mouth of the Columbia River, California. they've been shipping this stuff through the port of Vancouver. And Premier Christy Clark is saying, well, if you're going to get nasty with us on softwood, what if we just stop taking your coal through our ports? British Columbia produces the other kind of coal, metallurgical, used to make steel, not the heavy greenhouse gas stuff that's used that burned. So BC government's thinking we could block the thermal coal from the United States without hurting our own industry.
And President Trump has been big on coal. So what do you think is going to happen next?
Well, I hope after we have our exchange of rhetoric, we go to the table and start sorting this stuff out. As I said, I think we're going to lose the dairy argument. Our Australians and New Zealanders, everybody agrees that we're wrong on that one. So I don't think we'll win that. On softwood, I think we'll end up with an agreement. You mentioned the tariff is 20%, Bill. Actually, the fear on this side was that it was going to be even higher than that. So I think they can come up with an agreement. Usually what you end up with is a deal that restricts Canadian access to about a third, maybe a little less, 30% of lumber sales in the United States. I think that's where we'll end up on that. On the coal, I don't know about that one. It's such a strong environmental issue that if the Canadian government were to ban thermal coal shipments through Canada's ports, I don't think they could turn back on that one. So that may end up being like a completely different realm where you're mainly talking about an environmental issue rather than a trade one.
It wasn't long ago, Vaughn, we were talking about the Canadian government, I don't know, courting Trump.
Yeah.
You know, there's seemed like some positive signs.
Yeah, we tried. That's the other thing is, like, none of this, that's the other thing, Bill, right? None of this gets into NAFTA, because lumber is excluded from NAFTA by agreement way back Ronald Reagan era. So we don't even do lumber as part of NAFTA. NAFTA's reopening, well, we've already always known that's going to be a tough negotiation. But I don't think Canadian government is as worried about that one as the Mexican government. I think there's probably more that the United States government is looking for in a new NAFTA than it is from Canada. But, you know, the president needs some accomplishments. And as I said, we've kind of stupidly given him one with the dairy issue. But I do hope they sort it out on softwood. And I hope we don't get into retaliating because there's way too many Canadians and way too many Americans that would be hurt by a full-blown trade war.
Yeah, we have 1 minute left. I just want to note that you and I were briefly emailing yesterday, and the last thing you said was, this will get worse before it gets better. That was yesterday before the coal retaliation talk.
Yeah, I mean, that's what happens, right? Everybody puffs themselves up. And look, the Premier of British Columbia, we've got an election happening here on May the 9th. She did not want this softwood lumber thing coming down in the middle of a BC election. 60,000 British Columbians work in the lumber industry, 140 BC communities. Premier's got to show in the middle of an election she's standing up for BC, so that's partly what this is all about. Voting day here is May the 9th. And the election is close.
Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer, good to talk with you, Vaughn.
Bye-bye, Bill.
Finally on KOW's The Record, major Seattle football news today. Marshawn Lynch is now not only not a Seahawk anymore, he's a Raider. After retiring from Seattle last year and saying he was done with football, Lynch just signed a contract to play for Oakland. Now, if that feels wrong to you, one of your favorite Seattle stars leaving home, remember, Marshawn is not leaving home. He's coming home. He's from Oakland. But still, not the Raiders, you say? That's one of our biggest rivals. Where's the loyalty? Well, here, this will give you some healing perspective. This is Jerry Seinfeld telling David Letterman why loyalty to your hometown sports team is overrated anyway.
Team loyalty is a kind of hard thing to justify in the end. You know, I love the Giants, but when you think about it, who are the Giants? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? I mean, it's just, it's different guys. Every year it's different guys,
yeah.
Right? Teams will move from city to city. You're rooting for clothes when you get right down to it.
It's the same outfits.
It's the same. I'm rooting for an outfit. That's what it's come down to. I want my team's clothes to be the clothes from the other city.
That's not so bad either. There's nothing really wrong with
that. It's laundry. We're rooting for screaming about laundry here. People will, you know, like they'll love a guy, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then the guy will get traded. He'll come back on another team. They hate him now.
Yes,
this is the
right.
Same human being
that's
in a right. Different shirt. Boo, we hate him now. Different shirt.
Now, wait a minute.
Would you boo Marshawn Lynch if he returned to CenturyLink Field in an Oakland shirt? Or would you welcome him back with a standing ovation? Well, you won't have to choose right away. The Raiders don't play in Seattle next season. And this might make you feel better. Oakland is going to lose its entire team in 2 years. The Raiders will be changing shirts in 2019 and moving to Las Vegas. And one more sports note, ESPN is about to lay off 100 on-air personalities. They've been hemorrhaging subscribers and cutting costs, and we're going to talk more about that coming up on KUOW's All Things Considered.